Hey, welcome everybody. This is the very first episode of Wonder and All Podcast, my favorite topic. I'm Louis Schwartzberg, and I'll be your host. Many of you already know me from the films I've made to celebrate life, making the invisible visible by taking viewers on journeys through time and scale on important planetary issues like my recent film, Fantastic Fungi. My work has always combined the how of science and the why of art. And I've always seen wonder and awe as the intersection between art and science. Our podcast is going to bridge the realms of art and science that are equally critical as change agents in the battle to save our environment and all living creatures that are endangered. On each show, I'm going to be joined in a conversation with really special guests, one who bridges art and the other one and science in our common quest to find the answers for a way forward. Science continues to bear out what I've learned over many years of personal experience and filmmaking, namely that immersion in nature increases our capacity for creativity, kindness, and compassion, the components necessary in saving our world. I want to do a special thanks to Ruth Westrich and the Westrich Foundation. Ruth is a wonderful artist and leader in bringing art into the world of healthcare and education, a natural partner and sponsor for our Wonder and Art podcast. Today, I'm really proud to welcome my dear friends, Paul Stamets, to the podcast. He's a speaker, author, mycologist, entrepreneur, and a scientific expert in the fungi kingdom. His books include Mycelium Running, Mushrooms Can Help Save the World, Growing Gourmet and Medicinal Mushrooms, and Psilocybin Mushrooms of the World. He's also the editor and contributor to our companion book, Fantastic Fungi, How Mushrooms Can Heal, Shift Consciousness, and Save the Planet, which recently won the prestigious Nautilus Award for Best Environmental Work. I also want to introduce Merlin Sheldrake, the author of a brand new book, Entangled Life, How Fungi Make Our Worlds, Change Our Minds, and Shape Our Futures. He's a biologist and a writer with a background in plant sciences, microbiology, ecology, and the history and philosophy of science. He received a PhD in tropical ecology from Cambridge University for his work on underground fungal networks in tropical forests in Panama. He's also a musician, and he performs on the piano and the accordion. So I'd like to invite you to also share your questions for our guests throughout the live broadcast. Please submit the question in the comments section of the video. Our team will be reading them all. And don't forget to please tell me where you're writing from. Paul, Merle, and I have hung out at the summer gatherings at Hollyhock and Cortez Island in British Columbia. And we've engaged in many deep conversations about life and fungi. And it's really a miracle that we can virtually connect today. Paul, we met about 15 years ago when I showed him some of my time-lapse mushrooms at a Bioneers conference, and then we instantly bonded. I think it's a wonderful example of how a scientist and an artist comes together through a common vision. How has your sense of wonder and awe driven your scientific work, and how does that sense of wonder help you understand fungi in particular and the interconnectedness of all things in general?
Well, I first became fascinated with the microscopic universe when in 1974, I saw an article in the Seattle Times about a new scanning electron microscope at the Evergreen State College. I knew instantly there was cutting edge technology, and I wanted to go there to study fungi on the electron microscope. So I did a deep dive. I spent hundreds of hours in front of the scanning electron microscope, eventually teaching people scanning electron microscopy. It unveiled a whole new world that was invisible. And so I spent hundreds of hours listening to Grateful Dead tapes, you know, deep in the dungeon of the laboratory. It had to be in the lowest floor because of vibrations could distort the images. And then when I saw your work, Louis, it was like, oh my God, a dream come true. I now have found somebody else who is so in love and has these skill sets to be able to illustrate the microscopic universe, the macroscopic universe in slow motion and fast motion. And so it was really such a monumental meeting for us come together at the same time. So,
well, thank you, Paul. Think about it. Who would have thought that we'd be here like 15 years later after I started filming you, that Fantastic Fungi is launching on Apple TV today. I just got an email minutes ago. It's already in the top three. So please, everyone that's listening, tell your friends and spread the spores throughout the mycelial network. And I'm really excited to be sharing this film with the world. It's going to be opening up in the United States, Canada, South America, Australia, the UK, and Ireland. Merlin, in your new book, Entangled Life, How Fungi Make Our Worlds, Change Our Minds, and Shape Our Futures, I know it's currently one of the bestsellers on mushrooms on Amazon. You wrote about how every human being has a personal ecology of microbes. There's 40 odd trillion microbes that live in and on our bodies, which allow us to digest our food and produce key minerals that nourish us. I mean, it sounds like our body is an entire universe, that fungi live in plants to protect them, and they also live in us to protect us from disease and help digest our food. There's more bacteria in your gut than stars in the galaxy, you wrote. That truly does fill me with wonder and awe. So how do they all work in harmony? Who's running the show? Let's talk about that.
It's a good question. It's not always clear who's running the show. The best example to take is with a plant and a mycorrhizal fungal partner. And their relationship is intricately managed. And you can see it on the one hand as the plant farming the fungus, but on the other hand, you could see it as the fungus farming the plant. And this confusion is quite healthy. But these relationships defy our urge to apply neat categories or roles to these different players, because a mycorrhizal fungus, which is beneficial to the plant, which supplies it with nutrients, defends it from disease and more, if the conditions change, if other parts of the community drop in or out, that fungus can become actually parasitic and it can start to hoard nutrients rather than to pass them over. So these relationships are often ambiguous and slide along a spectrum of mutualistic, mutually beneficial to parasitic. A good example, there are bacteria in your gut that play a key role in your digestive processes, but if they get into your bloodstream, they can kill you, cause a sepsis that will kill you. So is that good or bad? These contexts are very important, which is why it's really important to think about the ecology, the setting in which these relationships are playing out.
So both of you have really helped develop this idea also of the Wood Wide Web, showing us how plants are socially networked by the fungi. I mean, it's amazing to reimagine life on Earth as a mycelial network. It's like a new model for maybe how we could live our lives socially and politically. It's a new approach to look at relationships. Is it more than just an information highway, or do they have agency in who they connect with and how they branch out?
The mycelium is a network-based designed organism. Evolution rewards that which is better able to survive catastrophia and ever-changing circumstances. Networks are intimately organized in that fashion. And so network-based organisms have a competitive edge because of the mutualistic alliances and the guilds of inviting other organisms that collaborate for the benefit of the commons. And so simply put, fungi create soils. Soils then allow plants and trees to ascend. And these are the mechanisms of nature that allow for the proliferation of life. So I think these fungi are deterministic, ultimately creating the habitats lead to sustainability, and they have the interests of not only themselves, but of the communities that empower that species to be able to spread its genetics far into the future.
It seems like nurturing is a force that exists in plants, not just animals. I'm curious, how does that expand our understanding of life beyond the narrow confines of human perception?
It's a good question. I like to think of it in terms of there's a researcher called Natasha Myers, and she is an anthropologist, and she uses this term involution to describe the way that organisms are constantly inventing new ways to live alongside each other. So the word evolution is a rolling outwards, and as she argues, it doesn't capture this tendency of organisms to associate with each other and to constantly invent new ways to associate with one another. And so when we think of this involution, we think of this constant inventing of new relational modalities. Collaboration is a nice word that encapsulates many of these. When we have collaboration, part of that can be competition, part of that can be cooperation, and maybe nurture we could think of as part of this suite of collaborative modalities and that might occur in some conditions with some organisms.
So Merlin, you know, you write in your book that biology, the study of living organisms, has transformed into ecology, the study of the relationships between living organisms. In other words, it seems like it's all about symbiosis, relationships, and networks. So I'm just curious, let's talk about that for a second. I mean, what did you learn by observing the leafcutter ants and the fungi?
So that's a great example, a great case study of symbiosis, because very quickly organism unspools into ecosystem. We have leafcutter ants, which depend on this fungi, which they cultivate. The fungus depends on the ants to cultivate it. They're reciprocally dependent. But it doesn't stop there. The ants are cultivating a monoculture, and like human monocultures, it's vulnerable to the spread of a parasitic fungus, which can race through and destroy an entire fungal garden in no time at all. So the ants have special glands on their bodies where they have bacteria. They house bacteria, which produce an antibiotic, which they use to protect their fungal crop against the parasitic fungal crop. And they also cultivate another type of bacteria, which fixes nitrogen from the air and fertilizes their fungal gardens. So it's not easy to talk about these leafcutter ants in the absence of their partners, which of course is the same with all organisms, because you know, even bacteria, big bacteria can have small bacteria living within them. And bigger viruses can have small viruses living within them. And this is just a fundamental feature of life. It's symbiosis all the way down. And Donna Haraway has a great line where she says that relationship is the smallest possible unit of analysis when it comes to living systems. And I think that's a really powerful thought.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it seems like, especially perhaps even in this pandemic, I mean, the great lesson we're all learning is this idea about cooperation and how we need to be able, how everything is interconnected and we need to work together. I think we have to kind of like reset the story that's been in media, our culture, entertainment, which was imposed upon us back in the days of Teddy Roosevelt and imperialism, how Darwin's theory of evolution was manipulated to justify invasion of third world countries and that narrative of survival of the fittest. Maybe what we need now more than ever is survival of the kindest, the stories of interconnection, regeneration, and nurturing, a more feminine and less macho view of nature, which was naturally imbued in Fantastic Fungi, which is why I had Brie Larson be the voice of fungi or Gaia energy. Making a documentary for me is a voyage of discovery, and I had no idea that interconnection was going to be the message and the takeaway from this film. Underground networks that share nutrients without greed for ecosystems to flourish. Do we have a model underneath our feet that could be the blueprint for how we restructure our political and economic systems, especially coming out of this pandemic? What do you think, Paul?
Well, I think it's more than just a metaphor. This is a blueprint for how we can navigate into a healthier and happier future. One of the things about the mycelial networks is called the nodes of crossing, and it's how well integrated the mycelial networks are. Mycelial networks, as they age, oftentimes loosen up. And then I like make the analogy, it's like a nylon sock becoming like a test net. And as these nets loosen up, then the successionism of the organisms occur, et cetera. But when the nodes of crossing are tight and well integrated, there is elasticity of responses that allows the mycelium to epigenetically code for new proteins that can fight off potential pathogens. And this is what we have now with scientists all over the world working to overcome COVID. We have all these nodes of crossing and an extended network of scientists who all recognize that viruses don't care about borders, viruses don't care about politics. We're all in this microbial soup together, and having as many scientists share information right now at a time critical. And what we've learned about COVID is that its effects on the human biology are very complex. It's multifactorial. and the downstream after effects, even with younger people, and this is really important to communicate, even though younger people may not show the symptoms, they may have lifelong disabilities that enter into their lifetime far sooner than otherwise would occur. So bear witness to this, young people. If you get COVID and you have mild symptoms, you might have ramifications 2 decades later in life that shortens your life because of the COVID inflammatory responses. So I think it's more than a metaphor. It is a blueprint of how we can cooperate. And Merlin mentioned about the leafcutter ants. They also cultivated lepiota mushroom mycelium over 25 million years ago. They developed this skill as a fungus farmer. So it is another example of a guild of an animal, an ant, bacteria, as Merlin described, fungi that also are being cultivated that select the bacteria that are antibiotic against the invasive fungus. So it just gives you a glimpse into the level of complexity that nature has already designed and evolved. And we're lumbering giants, Neanderthals with nuclear weapons that have the hubris of thinking that we're superior to nature. This is an inherent flaw of the human species. This is time for, it's a wake-up call. The collision of ecosystems, the loss of forests, loss of biodiversity, like rivets out of an airplane, we are having catastrophic failure. It's time for us to realign our vision and our responsibility for the future. First peoples, and especially indigenous peoples, adopting the philosophy of 7 generation was so prescient. That is what we have to adopt now. As every action that we take, how does it, like ripples in a pond, what's the ramifications of our actions well into the future? We have now prevent the destruction of habitats so we don't cause the destruction of future generations and our future, our present generation as well.
Well said, Paul. You know, it seems like the fungal kingdom seems to be having a moment now, culturally. I mean, not only because of, you know, fantastic fungi, but the interest in psilocybin research, the success of your book. I'm curious as to why you think that fungi, which are hidden and underground most of the time, seem to be mushrooming everywhere. I mean, I wonder if you have any thoughts as to why this is a moment that we're finally becoming aware of the largest organism on the planet and the largest kingdom on Earth.
I think there are a few reasons. So one is technological. So there are technologies that grant us access to these microbial worlds, which we simply didn't have access to even just a couple of decades ago. So these worlds are now opening up to us and we're able to access them. So there's this way that we can just extend our reach in a way that we couldn't before. And that does a huge amount for our ability to study these organisms. Of course, there are many things going on. I think one of the other reasons is that as the ecological crisis has worsened, and people have become more aware of the interdependencies of life and our intricate involvement in these shimmering networks of turnover and implication, that people have started to think more about ecology. And fungi embody the first principle of ecology, the relationship between organisms. They form enduring, persistent physical connections between organisms. And so I think they play into that ecological turn. Of course, we also have our digital networks. And as the rise of network science and has accompanied the rise of digital networks and our involvement with digital networks, I think people have used network more and more as a master concept to explain many, many things in many disciplines. And fungi also can ride in that network space, which has been created. Also, I think the mycoevangelism of you, Paul, has played a big part in this rise to power of fungi in this popular imagination. It shouldn't be neglected. Like in Star Trek, I mean, that's huge.
Yeah. Well, I and many of us share the experience of the epiphany of having a deeply spiritual and profound psilocybin experience where we live within a living network. Suddenly, our eyes we're no longer blind to the enormity of the reality that surrounds us. And our limited view of consciousness, a small slice, and we can make arguments as to why we don't see it all. But when we enter into the psilocybin microverse, we suddenly understand that everything is related. And it has been well argued and articulated from Steve Jobs to other pioneers of the computer internet. It's from their psychedelic experiences that open up their mind's eye to the potential of interconnectedness. This is what the computer internet has done. It's a repetition of a previously proven evolutionary successful model. But I present to you that psilocybin mushrooms may be a gateway into the multiverse. And I tend to say some controversial things. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're not. But I want to present this idea that we are now entering into a period of the chemistry of consciousness, that these molecules are able to allow us to connect with nature. And heretofore, not unprecedented, because indigenous people from all over the world, from Greece to Africa, to South America, to North America, to Ireland, you know, et cetera, they've all had the commonality of this experience. And I think this awakens the creativity and the imagination. To date, right now, there are 47 studies on psilocybin mushrooms at 26 academic institutions, from Harvard to Stanford, to the University of Pennsylvania, to Imperial College in London. This is extraordinary. Never has there been approved by the governments of those countries so many clinical studies, because psilocybin has been proved to be so safe and non-addictive, and one experience can have a lifelong effect. And this is amazing to have a medicine where the experience itself, by re-remembering the experience years later, you get a therapeutic benefit. And so the potential, the hypothesis is that for PTSD, for end of life, et cetera, the anxiety that you previously experienced, by reconciling it through your psilocybin experience, the memory of that psilocybin experience now supplants and overwrites, in a sense, the PTSD experience, et cetera. So we are really, and we know now from the research we've been doing, that the psilocybin analog, these are not psychoactive substances that are related to psilocybin, causes neurogenesis, that stimulates neurons to grow. And so when you have more synaptic junctions, more neurological growth, you have more potential for cross-fertilization of ideas, more nodes of crossing. You can share that with other people who have more nodes of crossing. So I think psilocybin mushrooms increases intelligence, makes nicer people, and allows our society to be healthier. And the return on investment to society by reducing crime and the pain and the suffering and criminality is hard to overestimate the benefits.
Well, Paul, that's a deep dive into consciousness, which is great. So I'm just curious, like, do you think consciousness is inside of us or outside of us? I mean, is this networking energy in your body, or is it just a cellular mass of bones, organs, and cells? I know that as human beings, we're like in the 80 percentile of giant creatures on the planet. And so, like, for example, like, what is your brain? Is it neural energy that's traveling through your brain every millisecond? Or is it a collection of cells we call the brain?
I think Merlin can speak to this, but I think we share in the concept that our envelope is a permeable membrane. We are constantly, you know, shedding DNA, absorbing, you know, from cross-species DNA contributions from our mere contact with soils. Well known that children should play in the soil and get dirty because it's better for their microbiome and their immunity. But Merlin, I would like to hear your thoughts on this.
It's a big one, isn't it? So, I mean, networks themselves, if you think of our brain as a network of neurons, and we often think of our brains as networks of neurons, we come up against this problem with network models where, because networks are made of nodes and links, we make networks when we can identify nodes to string together into links. So there is, in network models, there's often this hidden reductivism. But in our brains, there is more than this spinning network of electrical circuits. We have dynamic fields of electromagnetic activity that pass across and within our brain. And these dynamic fields act back on the neurons which are firing, which create these fields in the first place. There are these positive feedback loops. And there's a great interesting theory of consciousness, which is by a guy called John McFadden, who's a biological researcher. And he suggests that these electrical fields, electromagnetic fields around the brain, are the physical substrate of consciousness. And it's a nice theory because it helps to overcome this reductive, tacit reductive part of networks, because fields are inherently integrative. So in these dynamic electrical fields, we can imagine a way that this combined activity of billions of neurons could come together to form the coherent phenomenon of mind.
You know, we just got a question from Isaac Cruz from Mexico City. He was wondering if fungi have a nervous system as complex as us, as animals. I'm interested. He says he's interested to know if they can feel pain just as we do. And I had a question about that as well. You know, I've always been really fascinated by slime molds. And I think we can learn so much from these, like, you know, branching networks. And then there's this experiment that I know both of you are aware of, and I think it's in your book too, how the slime molds created a more efficient subway system than the engineers in Japan could do. Can either of you just quickly share this incredible experiment they did in Japan relating to their subway system?
The idea was that slime molds, like mycelial fungi, have very efficient space-searching growth forms. And so they wanted to see if they placed oats on a to-scale map of the Tokyo Greater Tokyo Transport Network, would the slime mold link these in the way that they recognized by looking at their own subway map? And they found that in the space of an afternoon, the slime mold did emanate into a network which looked very much like their existing transport network. And so actually this group are now using slime molds to develop big urban planning projects because they are as or more efficient than human devised space searching algorithms.
So what I think is pretty fascinating is that these kind of mind-blowing ideas comes from observing, you know, nature's intelligence. I mean, another, you know, wonderful example I think of this symbiosis is just photosynthesis, right? I mean, the biggest maybe symbiotic relationship on the planet, the fungal and the plant kingdoms working together to sequester carbon underground while releasing oxygen for us to breathe. And perhaps that's the greatest natural solution for climate change. So Merlin and Paul, I mean, what can we do to accelerate and amplify these natural engines?
It's a good question. I had a thought the other day, less about photosynthesis and more about the other great biogeochemical cycles, these chemical weather systems that surround and encircle the planet and which guide the behavior of so many organisms and in which so many organisms participate, including ourselves. I've always been fascinated by decomposition and how these fungi are able to drive these huge cycles, which are invisible to us and so hard for us to tune into. So I thought of this idea, maybe I'd like to bounce it off you and see what you think, Louis and Paul. And the idea was to generate wonder and awe and to make visible some of these decompositionary processes by having a competition. So micro-hackers could enter and race their own home-trained fungal strains through fiendish cocktails of toxic waste, competing for an annual award of $1 million to start with. And I'd like a cross between the Formula One race and a dog show. And we could have all this amazing time-lapse media. So this would be available, accessible to people around the world watching. And in this awe and wonder that these biochemical processes would engender, as well as fueling the development of micro-remediation technologies, which we urgently need, it would encourage people to think of themselves as situated within these huge biogeochemical cycles and would contribute to a general awareness of these climate change processes, which are so otherwise intangible. I was thinking the Stamets Prize, and we have to design this very carefully. And there's lots of details that would have to be worked out about how the competition would be run.
Well, that was very gracious of you. I have a lot of thoughts on this. We did experiments with Battelle Laboratories. We broke down dioxins. We trained fungi to be specifically targeting dioxins in a petri dish. When we applied those fungi in nature, you know, it's like a menu of food. You're at the banquet. What's the easiest food to acquire and consume? So the fungi were not going after the dioxins, even though they were doing so in a petri dish. But in nature, there's all sorts of other potential food sources. So it chose the food sources that it was easier for it to acquire. So targeting specific toxins with micro-remediation, when you put it in situ in nature, you have to overcome the choice test that fungi have to be able to choose something that's more palatable, that's more part of their ancestral, you know, beginnings than consuming a dioxin. However, I do have a challenge, and I think this is important. So let me just segue into mushrooms create climate. The nuclei of spores then condense water droplets that create rain. So these fungi, when they go into an ecosystem, they create positive climate change by condensing water that create rain that then go into the soils that punish, that give plant growth, that creates plant debris fields that feed the mycelium, and on it goes. Well, we know now the carbon fibers of mycelium can be nanobatteries. And Elon Musk, I'm a great fan of Elon Musk and Sergey Brin and all these other great thinkers. I think going to Mars is the wrong idea right now. We should cure the problems on this planet, but it's nice to have an escape hatch. But the idea of creating houses made of mycelium, micromaterials, and then have the houses, because the nanowires of, and the mycelium is 80, 85% carbon fibers, that we could use solar panels and have basically micromaterials that would be highly insulative to create human habitats, then with solar panels, then the house itself becomes a battery. And moreover, you can program these nanowires to be microcomputers that would be target specifically trained to address issues that your family, your community, the ecosystem needs to address. So the elasticity, because of the carbon fibers, the conductivity, and this also speaks to folklorically, if lightning strikes, mushrooms will come up. Now we know actually electricity stimulates mushroom formation. And so looking at the integrated circuits that have already the mycelial networks create, miles of mycelium per cubic inch, all these nodes are crossing, hyperaccumulation of certain metals, silver in particular, the conductivity of the mycelial networks, how they interface with bacterial communities. I think we have the potential, the ingredients here for a really creative paradigm shifting breakthrough and human habitation living with mycelial, within the mycelial microcosm, and create structures that allow us to go into space, to be able to use the mycelium for power storage, use it as the intelligent networks, interface our computer technology with that of nature's innate internet technology, and that is that of mycelium.
It's an interesting thought, and I think really powerful one. And there's a group in England who are working on this already, but they're getting the mycelial networks to be conductive by encouraging them to take up small metal particles. So when they die, they are these nanowires that they've encouraged them to become. But Andrew Adamatsky, who's running this project, he has this great idea, which is that if we can learn to decode the natural electrical impulses which pass through many types of mycelial network already, and we could use these, say, a big network strung through a forest floor, and we could plug in, we could decode these signals, and we could treat this mycelial network as a kind of biosensor, because this mycelial network is surrounded, it's flooded in sensory information. It's sensitive to all this sensory information. It can integrate these data streams. And if we only knew how to decode that, and Adamatsky suggests, we would have access to this amazing organic self-growing sensor. So I think that's another exciting thing we could do.
Yeah, I described that in mycelium running. But we are at the good thing about a catastrophe, the good thing about a pandemic is it gets a lot of people, you know, motivated to come up with creative solutions. And oftentimes with startup companies, with new technologies, your original intention and your target will have splits on the roads of creativity that will come up with something even more powerful. So I think this is the milieu that we are creating with all these inspired mycologists now coming into the field around the world. They should be challenging their professors to do applied mycology. And this is where I'm a disruptor in the field of mycology. I've had many mycologists say, Paul, it's great what you've done for the field of mycology, but you've made our job more difficult. Students want to come in to save the world with mycelium, and we don't know how to do it. So they're demanding, and I think that's good. That students should demand, you know, a higher order of intelligence from the professors than them just teaching by rote, you know, the same program over and over. It takes that prodding of questions. And I go back to psilocybin mushrooms. The majority of the woodland psilocybin mushrooms are hidden in nature. Here in the Pacific Northwest, with Psilocybe sinensis and lots of other species, you don't find them in the middle of the woods, in an old growth forest, or in a deciduous forest. You only find them when humans cut down the forest and they create debris fields. And then suddenly, with the invention of beauty bark, all these psilocybin mushrooms started appearing that mycologists had not seen before prior to the invention of beauty bark, landscaping mulch around buildings. And suddenly, landscaping mulch around universities, churches, police stations, courthouses. That's interesting. And so these psilocybin mushrooms seem to leap forward, islands of the cognoscente that need to have a paradigm shift in consciousness. So I, just like the leafcutter ants, association, not causation, but there could be a blend of both. And the fact that we are cutting the forest and chipping the wood and the sudden surgence of psilocybin mushrooms make them available for people to consume. Hopefully, we have the cognitive fuel for creating new solutions that can help the ecosystem and ultimately the commons. Because I think these fungi have long-term goals in mind. They are not short-term in just our lifetime or their lifetime. They're trying to create sustainable ecosystems that benefit not only themselves, but the commons of the other organisms that are helping us get there.
It seems like we're living in a really interesting time of breakdown and breakthrough. You know, breakdown of old-fashioned systems like fossil fuel economy, politics, et cetera. But the stuff you guys are talking about are such wonderful breakthroughs that offers, I think, hope and solutions, especially, I think, to younger people that are hearing the hardcore science and feeling like your future is doomed. I wonder, can you guys share maybe some of the hopeful solutions you think are like around the corner? I know that, Paul, besides shifting consciousness, you've talked also about neurogenesis, the fact that lion's mane mushrooms are helpful with dementia or Alzheimer's and turkey tail with cancer. I mean, what solutions are around the corner that you guys are dreaming about?
I'll take this. Yeah, you're Mr. Solution.
Well, there's three areas in particular that I am extraordinarily excited about. One is I'm 65 years of age. I don't feel 65. I feel like I'm 35, but that's what the calendar says. And age-related dementia, the slow slide into age-related dementia and being not able to articulate or pass on the knowledge to people like Merlin and the younger generation. We have Einsteins dying every day. What is the cost to society of the loss of that body intellect to our society? So, cognitive decline is a threat to national security, to international security, to not being able to come with solutions to COVID. So I think that psilocybin, especially stacked with lion's mane, psilocybin mushrooms should be legal. They hopefully will become legalized for end of life here in Canada, where I am right now, in a remote island in British Columbia. Lion's mane mushrooms have no illegality aspects to them. They've been shown by several clinical studies to promote neurogenesis, to fight mild cognitive decline. There are some clinical studies ongoing now and have been published. I have a unbranded, non-commercial website just for physicians and scientists called mushroomreferences.com. And I told Sergey Brin, thank you for Google Scholar alerts, because it's now sucked up the majority of my free time, because I get too many Scholar alerts on fungi, but I populate that with my team, the most significant medicinal references, including clinical studies on the medicinal properties of mushrooms. So mushroomreferences.com, great search engine, hundreds of pages long now that bring people up the learning curve. And there's such an avalanche of information coming out. The psilocybin clinical studies, there's numerous ones that are ongoing. End of life is really important. We're all going to die. You have to become a criminal in order for you to reconcile the meaning of death, your last days of your life? I don't think so. What are they gonna do, arrest you after you die? I mean, we have the right for our own consciousness. This is a basic human right. These psilocybin mushrooms have a societal benefit. With any powerful tool, they can't be abused, there's no doubt about it, but the abuse potential has already been published by senior researchers, Johns Hopkins in particular. There's very, very little abuse potential. They are powerful. You should not run a nuclear power plant or fly a 747 airplane high in psilocybin mushrooms. I can't even believe you have to say that. But some people go, oh, they're dangerous. Well, lots of things are dangerous in life. It's a matter of your responsible use and understand the framework of use. But so psilocybin neurogenesis is really exciting. My research with my colleagues on saving bees from colony collapse, we published in Nature. And our article in Nature using mushroom extracts, mycelial extracts to fight viruses, still is in the top 1% of all articles published in the Nature publication ecosystem. So those skeptics out there are scientists. They could go, Sam is not a scientist. Well, have you published in Nature? You know, a little bit of a cause celeb for me because I do feel challenged and I don't have a PhD. You know, I couldn't go to graduate school because I married a woman 11 years older than me when I adopted her kids, you know, by 12, 14 and 16 when I was 22. So I couldn't afford to go to graduate school. So I, you know, basically created the mechanism for my own continued research. So that's areas that I think is really powerful that we need to explore, is that the same species that reduce viruses in bees, reduce viruses, according to the BioShield Biodefense Program, of which I was a participant, flu viruses, herpes viruses, pox viruses. Well, the fact that these same mushrooms reduce viruses in bees, swine flu, bird flu, herpes, pox viruses, I think I've discovered something fundamental to the foundation of life, is that the mycelial networks influence the immunological health of the animal inhabitants resident within their ecosystems. And by tapping into the mycelial networks, we tap into nature's immunity and we benefit from that. I think the research on mitigating viruses and pathogens that are resident in the ecosystem through the homeostasis of these mycelial networks contribute to is a vast well of knowledge that we can dip into, where we're not looking for a single constituent. We're looking at upregulation of immunity that consequentially allows your innate immune system to keep pathogens at bay. And I think that's a much bigger picture. The pathogens of any sort in any ecosystem, I think the mycelial networks can contribute to our biodefense. Our biosecurity is dependent upon biodiversity.
So, Paul, when we were like making Fantastic Fungi, I was also, you know, finishing up Wings of Life, which was narrated by Meryl Streep. And she tells the story of flowers from the point of view of her relationship with pollinators, bees, bats, hummingbirds, and butterflies. It's a love story that feeds the earth, is how I describe it. And for those of you who haven't seen it, it's actually available now on Disney Plus. And during our filming, I kept talking to you about colony collapse disorder, you know, what you were just describing, the critical importance of bees on our planet. And I kept on saying, Paul, you got to come up with a solution for this.
That's true, Louis. I mean, it was from your question, Paul, can't you do something? I get these questions a lot. Can't you do something? And I went, yeah, I think I can do something. So, Louis, I give you credit for that. It was the artist, you know, seeing and witnessing the collapse of pollination, and it struck you to the core in your heart. It caused you anguish, and you mentioned it to me. And then I had a series of waking dreams and epiphanies, and I took that as a call to action. So I give you enormous credit for the artist intersecting with the science and saying, you know, can you just do something to help? So, and this is the way it should be. If we live in our bubbles, isolated from one another, and we don't talk outside of our bubbles and have that, you know, sort of permeable membrane of ideas, then we will not move forward as a society.
No, I think, well, thank you, Paul, but I think it's really the perfect example of that intersection of art and science being fueled by wonder and awe, by curiosity, by asking the big question, by being present, by observing, you know, the intelligence of nature. I want to be able to actually, I can share some of this magic that I think I blew Paul's mind with. I remember we had a screening, remember, at the Directors Guild. I think you were sitting in the front row and seeing it on a mega screen, perhaps the best theater in all of LA or the world. I think it like activated some neurological, you know, networks that had been like, you know, dormant for a while. I think when people see nature's intelligence, it rings true, right? It's not like I'm trying to make a science movie. I never have gotten awards for doing that, but I'm just trying to show reality beyond human vision. And that to me, you know, opens up your perspective, your heart, and makes you more compassionate to all life on our planet. You know, so Paul, once you came up with this great idea about putting, you know, the mushroom extract, you know, into, you know, the beehives, and that's like, you know, an experiment you're doing, I know, with Washington State University and these giant almond groves, an idea that's going to really help, you know, industry and agriculture and ourselves too, because that's where we get all our almonds and, you know, fruits that need to be pollinated. But then you went and invented a new kind of bee feeder that depends on citizen science. And it's going to play a really big part in saving and regenerating wild and local bee colonies. I want to ask you about the progress that you've made with this in developing this invention and the idea that citizens and scientists can play in that development.
Well, we made 1,000 of them. I've committed to giving it 10 to 20,000 away for free. We do have a website, so I'm not commercializing this. It's fungi.com/bees. You can sign up for it. We have a lot of people on the wait list right now because of COVID. It's caused some problems with our supply chain. And our bee feeder is ostensibly for wild bees. The wild bees are suffering from these viruses as well. They've been transmitted putatively from honeybees. The Apis mellifera, the cultivated bee, has now vectored these viruses to bumblebees and wild bees, which reportedly gives 80% of the pollination benefit to farmers, not just the cultivated honeybee. So we are struggling to get liftoff on this. We've been working with a big computer company. So there's a maze inside. There'll be lasers for counting the entry of bees, the type of bees coming in, the type of pollen they're carrying, uploads into the cloud. So it becomes its own sort of Wi-Fi internet. And then in the cloud, then we can look at pollination activity all over the world and then be able to help mitigate and help the immune system of these bees and mitigate some of the stressors that they're receiving. It used to be that bees flew for 9 days, 1,000 flowers per day on average, 9,000 flowers. Now their average is about 4 days of flight. So we lost 5,000 flowers, 5 days, 5,000 almonds, berries, fruits, et cetera. So this is a citizen scientist effort to be able to get people excited. They give these away to schools. We'll have 3D printing available. We'll upload the program. Paul Taylor and I have been working on this. He's our team leader on this project. So I can't overpromise and underdeliver because of the challenges that we face now. We do have 1,000 that we've given away, and we have many tens of thousands that I'm committed to giving away, but I don't know what my financial bandwidth is to supply bee feeders to the world. So I think with 3D printing and allowing people to print their own bee feeders, that'll be one way of helping the commons. So stay tuned. I like to think about big ideas, but I don't necessarily achieve every idea that I think of, but I certainly love trying.
Well, you're out there, Paul. You're definitely on the cutting edge of stuff. I mean, how many other mycologists on Earth have had a Star Trek character named after them?
Anthony Rapp does such a good job. And CBS came to me, as they said, they were in the dungeon. They're stuck. They're writing the next Star Trek. Do you have any ideas? I said, turn on your recorder and let me just rip on this. And I told them in the middle of this, I always wanted to be the first astromycologist. And I give you all these ideas. I don't want any revenue or royalties or anything can happen. And they said, astromycologist, we can use that. And so the idea of using fungi for terraforming other planets, et cetera. So I gave them the skeleton of the idea. And then the writers just did a great job. And I'm really in love with women warrior types. And what I love about the Star Trek Discovery series is there's lots of great women warrior figures that come into play. But science fiction predicts science fact. Look at the flip phone is kind of antiquated now, but when it came out, it was, everyone referred to Star Trek. I had the flip phone, the transcorder we don't have necessarily, but we're developing those. So, but another example where art influences science, science influences art, is a fertile ecosystem for creativity. And that's what I enjoy, not being in a university environment, not worrying about tenure, because I think of the biggest harm to academic imagination is the fear of being ridiculed by other scientists, and that diminishes your potential for retirement, tenure, et cetera. So it is an unfortunate adversarial factor in stifling creativity, because Terrence McKenna is a good friend of mine. I made fun of him all the time. But as his brother said, Dennis, if only 5% of Terrence McKenna's ideas are truthful, that's hugely significant. And that's what I think that we need to explore the possibilities that a few of these ideas will be founded in fact, and much of the indigenous knowledge of use of mushrooms are now very well scientifically supported, from lightning strikes to the influence of sound to, you know, mushrooms forming clouds and causing rain, that sort of reciprocal relationship. I think this is time for scientists to sit back and not be so skeptical about these ideas that these young people are coming up with, because I think some of them will be paradigm shifting.
Yeah. I think it was only the last couple of hundred years that they separated, you know, let's say art from science, the idea that there should be some type of spiritual essence to both sides of that coin. I mean, that line that I became an astromycologist because of awe at the miracle of life, is such a beautiful phrase. I mean, Merlin, how do you think awe changes us? And what makes the experience of awe so powerful?
It's a good question, isn't it? And when I've experienced awe, I've felt that it loosens the grip of my certainties, that it decalcifies my the things that I think I know and the ways that I think I know. And it allows me to float in ambiguity. And in that space, I feel curious and I feel small and I feel vulnerable. And these are all really helpful medicines, I think, for our human-centeredness, certainly for my human-centeredness. And it's actually been backed up by studies recently, a few studies from last year. And they find consistently that experiences of awe are corrosive to dogma. That people who have the people who are shown awe-inspiring scenes of galaxies or the Northern Lights, that they hold views on capital punishment with less conviction, that they interpret political debates in a less polarized way, that they're better able to see the gaps in their own knowledge. And I think this ties into what you were saying, Paul, in a big way, that when we, if we can up our doses of awe, and tune us back into why it is that we're asking questions about the world in the first place, and to loosen our dogmas, to dissolve our dogmas in awe, then perhaps we'll be able to further our inquiries and to think further and to travel further in our journey towards knowledge and compassion.
It's really true, Merlin. I mean, I think that you're a wonderful example because you're a musician and a scientist. And I've really marveled at your talents being able to do both.
Well, I'd already been feeding the books to this Pleurotus fungus. And then my brother Cosmo, who you know, who's very keen on recording sounds from the natural world and finding the music in them. He suggested that we send the books to our friend who's a sound ecologist, Michael Priam, who has this device which can interpret bioelectrical activity in the form of sound. So it's not that the fungus is making that noise, but the electrodes are recording the bioelectric activity of the fungus and turning it into sound so that we can hear it. So it's a way of making the inaudible, the imperceptible, perceptible. It's a bit like how you do your work, Louis, with the time lapse and Paul with the microscopy. And so it was just a way of tuning into to what the fungus was doing right then at that time. And it was a bit of a joke. You know, we just wanted to know what it was doing while it was digesting the book about fungi digesting things in the world. So it was a little goof, really, but a goof to remind us that that even when we talk about the world, we're still part of these cycles. We cannot step outside that.
Well, I love it. I really love it. You know, both of you have contributed to the Fantastic Fungi Reimagine album. Paul, I know you teamed up with Desert Dwellers, who used your voice from the movie. And then Merlin, your fungi devouring a book clip, it was also turned into a track on the album. For people that are watching, you can support the album on Kickstarter now. And we just added a new track from Jason Mraz this week. And speaking of interconnections, Merlin, I mean, your younger brother Cosmo scored the Galapagos episode for my moving art series on Netflix. So how has music inspired and informed your science?
That's a good question. I mean, I've just been brought up playing music, and so it's kind of like a bodily function. It's just something that I do Like I eat, I sleep, I play music. And so it's just a basic way that I engage with the world. And I feel very lucky to have been encouraged to play music when I was young. But it's also, it helps me think, it helps me imagine. And it does feed into the science, I think, in quite real ways. One of the ways that it strikes me is that it helps to remind me that the universe is a process made up of processes, not things. We like to think about things as things, but actually things are usually processes. This is something which eludes us. But music itself is a process. You cannot have a musical note at an instant. It needs time to unfold it. And so when you're hearing music, it's a processual encounter with this sound. And so when we listen to music in the way that the notes wind in and out of relation, they wind in and out of stability, chaos and stability happen in this sound. And I think that enacts something fundamental about the way that the universe happens. And so I find that really a helpful way to tune in.
That's incredible.
In an obscure journal, it was recently discovered that low-frequency sound waves stimulate mycelium to grow. Well, we know that lightning strikes, we stimulate mushrooms to form from mycelium. We know that they're conductive. We know, just from what you described, Merlin, that there is an interface between sound and electrical conductivity. And this recent article showed that mycelium is stimulated by low sound frequencies. So it inspired the idea that I had that it is perhaps when there are drum circles or celebrations and there's these low vibrational frequencies of people toning and they're celebrating the birth of a child, a harvest, a marriage, that when there are people resonating and singing together and drumming, the vastness of the mycelial network underneath your feet are like strings of a violin or a piano or a guitar, and they're resonating, they're vibrating. And because they're vibrating, we know now they grow faster, they are giving more nutrients to the ecosystem. Well, that results in more fruit, more berries, richer forests. And so I think the mycelium is listening. It is sentient. It is paying attention. And that indigenous people had these rituals, you know, from Europe to North America, South America, all over the world. But I think it's much more powerful than any of us have realized. Maybe intuitively, our ancestors and other peoples have realized this. But now scientifically, I think that the celebration of nature is listening and reciprocates with the fruits of their appreciation for the fact that we are recognizing the importance of nature, and the mycelial networks are the conduit of that nutrient flow being upregulated to help us all. I think that's really profound.
I think so too. So, you know, Paul, Sarah always says every time I'm on location, nature just kind of opens up for me. And it's there because, you know, I think it happens a lot of times because I'm there to honor it. I'm not there to try to, you know, force it or direct anything. It can start off being completely foggy, then the fog clears and there's this beautiful landscape, or by miraculously there's a snowfall that puts a dust on everything. If you're there to honor anything, if you're there to honor any relationship, it will honor you. I think that is karma and the law of the universe. So, you know, one of the things that also struck true to me is, as well, Paul, when you're speaking about this stuff, is that especially with indigenous cultures, we live, I think, in a brave new world, because I'm bringing music and nature's imagery into hospitals to treat people with anxiety, stress, addiction, and sleep disorders. And later this year, we're going to be doing a clinical trial at the Pacific Neuroscience Institute in Santa Monica using psilocybin and my visual healing imagery to treat patients with alcohol, you know, disorders, to see if they can, one treatment can be a cure, which would be really, really remarkable. And so I think we're on exciting times. It is a brave new world, and we are breaking barriers with this kind of research that you're doing and, you know, other scientific, spiritually minded people are doing around the planet. I also want to be able to, you know, again, express my thanks to, you know, Ruth Westrich from the Westrich Foundation. This podcast is being supported by them. It's an organization that supports change makers around the world and gives a voice to the unheard. They're dedicated to supporting art, media, and research to create awareness and educate. And we both believe we can inspire, connect, and support planetary change through art, science, and dialogue. We've had a lot of questions, but I think we've kind of run long on time. What I'd like to do is all these questions are going to be saved and answered when we post this online. I want to also do a giant shout out and thank you to my team at Moving Art, to Leland and Annie and Courtney, and to the wonderful folks at Magical Threads, Bethany, Ron, Jason, and Bobby. This is going to be available on our Moving Art YouTube channel. So Pablo, who I affectionately call, and Merlin, I want to thank you from the deepest part of my heart for this incredible conversation. It brings me back to my days at UCLA when I was a freshman. We would sneak out behind the dorm, we'd smoke a joint, and I'd hang out with all the smart kids, the seniors and juniors who are the chemistry majors, who we talk about Einstein's theory of relativity and black matter and dark holes, all kinds of cool stuff. I would just try to hang on and understand. And it was way more invigorating and inspiring for me than any class I ever took at UCLA. So thank you for going and sharing on the journey of brainstorming and riffing. I really nurture and love that kind of experience. Thank you so, so much. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, thank you, Merlin, for ascending to your new position of being a mycologist of renown. And you know, the torch is being passed to you, so carry it high with honor, courage, and kindness.
Well, thank you, Paul, for being such an inspiration for so many and for this big new renaissance in mycological thinking and vision and inspiration. And thanks, Louis, so much for hosting us both and creating the space for us to have this conversation.
So our art and work will survive our lives. And Louis, you have such a potent heritage to leave for the future generations, and you will forever be honored. So deep gratitude to you, brother.
Thank you. I guess we learned from nature, like reproduction is a way to overcome dying and entropy. So we'll put our messages and stories into media so they can be experienced generation after generation. It is truth, it is knowledge, it's nature's intelligence, it's wisdom. I'm honored to be a messenger in that great story. So thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank all of you. May the spores be with you. And tell your friends to watch Fantastic Fungi. It's available on Apple TV, and it'll be available everywhere throughout the universe. Thank you, guys.
All right.